want to talk with you this week and next. Just shuffling the schedule a little bit here. On 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, I've shared with on these passages before, but I think they need to be revisited. When I think I've shared on something, and I sometimes I'll go back in my notes, and I say, well, I did it last year, and it's been like 6 years or 10 years. And then I realized that people who are in their 20s weren't listening in the same way. And those of us who are older are...
Or either.
Yeah, they may not have been listening either or have forgotten. So, and this passage came to me when Eric was speaking a couple of weeks ago in a devotion, and he spoke about our use of money, or triggered that thought. So I'll try and go through chapter 8 today and chapter 9 next week. They're long. Today I want to read to you just the verse 15 of chapter 8. I think that's the bulk of what I'll speak on, and I'll say a few words about the last part of chapter 8. I'm going to divide these two chapters into three sections for those of you who want to keep track of where I am and what I'm speaking about. The first section is chapter 8 and goes down to verse... verse 7. And that section is the what I label the grace of giving. So the main theme in there to be nurtured is this issue of grace. The second section is a long one, starting in verse 8 of chapter 8, and then going right through chapter 9 up to verse 7. And I would call those the principles of giving. And then the last section in chapter 9, beginning of verse 8 to the end, is the blessing of giving. So it's the grace of giving and the principles of giving and then the blessing of giving. So let's read with that in mind then the first part of chapter 8 down to verse 15. I want you to know, brothers, about the grace of God that has been given among the churches of Macedonia. For in the severe test of affliction, their abundance of joy and their extreme poverty have overflowed in the wealth of generosity on their part. But they gave according to their means, as I can testify, and beyond their means of their own accord, begging us earnestly for the favor of taking part in the relief of the saints. And this not as we expected, but they gave themselves first to the Lord, and then by the will of God to us. Accordingly, we urged Titus that as he had started, so he should complete among you this act of grace. But as you excel in everything, in faith and speech and knowledge, in all earnestness and in our love for you, see that you excel in this act of grace also. I say this not as a command, but to prove by the earnestness of others that your love is also genuine. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor. So that you by his poverty might become rich. And in this matter I give my judgment. This benefits you who a year ago started not only to do this work, but also to desire it. So now finish doing it as well, so that your readiness in desiring it may be matched by your completing it out of what you have. For if the readiness is there, it is acceptable according to what a person has, not according to what he does not have. For I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but that as a matter of fairness, your abundance at the present time should supply their need, so that their abundance may supply your need, that there may be fairness. As it is written, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. And then the remainder of the chapter, which I probably won't read those verses, we'll see how time unfolds here, has to do with people who are coming to the Corinthians to help them with collecting the gift. There's a very strong theme through both chapters of others coming to Corinth. Titus, and they mention a brother, just a brother who's known for preaching the gospel. And then there's other brothers, which are probably Jewish brothers, who relate to the church in Jerusalem where this gift is going. And there's a lot said about others helping the Corinthians to gather this gift and get it on its way. Now, the Just one word about the context of these chapters. Some of you, I'm sure, know this, but there was a famine that went through, or a severe period of testing that went through Jerusalem. And the saints in Jerusalem were very needy. And there are other parts now, as this gospel is spreading, particularly among the Gentiles, that were much better off. And Paul has a tremendous burden to collect money among the Gentile churches and bring it to the church in Jerusalem to relieve their burdens, especially because many of the believers there were Jewish believers, and he had this particular burden for his own people, even though he was called as an apostle to the Gentiles. And we read about that in Romans 9, 10, and 11. This is a very important work in Paul's mind, and so he's taking a lot of time and care in executing it, and collecting the money, and gathering it, and then bringing it. And he says a lot in the later part of this chapter, in sending Titus and the others, to try and do it in a way that looks noble inside the wall. That's one of the principles. We'll get to that a little later. But that's the context into which this is going on. And so while I think this is the most prominent chapters in the New Testament about giving, it does have this particular context. This is not, you see somebody who's tired and is having trouble making meals and kind of running the household, and you quietly go over and drop a meal off and scoot out before they know who you are, or you hand somebody some money who said, don't tell this person where it came from. I don't want them to know where it's coming from. And there's these secretive givings that we do and should do, where Jesus says that the right hand does not know what the left is doing. That has a very wonderful and appropriate place. But then there are these acts of corporate giving that have different kind of ways in which you need to approach them. It's very, very difficult to coordinate a large gift from a church to another church or to a needy area without talking about it, talking about what the need is, who has the need, and how the money will be collected, or how the care or services will be collected and delivered. So there's this need for coordination. So having said that, now I want to look at the first 8 verses, which I think in some ways are the most important ones for the chapter. Because whether you give quietly, or whether you give in a more public and coordinated effort, however it is that you are being burdened to give at a particular time or led to give at a particular time, some of the teachings here about grace and some of the principles of giving apply. And so the first part really is not about the Corinthians, but about the Macedonians. And you notice that we want you to know, brothers, meaning the brothers in Corinth, we want you to know about the grace of God that has been given among the churches of Macedonia. That's not the Corinthians, that's somewhere else. And one of the things that Paul is doing here, that's a very, very unusual thing. I'm gonna skip ahead to this and then come back to the passage. Verse 8, which is the transition verse into the area of principles. I say this not as a command, meaning to give this gift, but that to prove by the earnestness of others that your love also is genuine. That is a complicated sentence. Every time I read this passage, there's 2 or 3 verses in it that I go back to and say, now, do I understand what this means? Because he's saying, I'm going to compare you to Macedonians. Now, parenthetically, at this snapshot in time when he's writing this letter, it's not a favorable comparison, because the Macedonians have given generously and the Corinthians have not. They haven't given at all. And we'll get into that a little bit more. But what he says here is, I'm going to compare you to the Macedonians because I want you to realize something. Now, if I was thinking, well, you're going to compare me to somebody else who does something much better than me, and they're doing it, and I'm not doing it, then the comparison's going to be, you got to do better than you're doing. You know, take a look at them over there. But that's not really what he says. I mean, they do have to do better, and he talks a lot about that. But that's not the emphasis here in this first section. First of all, he says that what I'm telling you is not by way of a command. I'm not saying you have to give this money. He's saying you should. And he tells you, he says why elsewhere, and we'll get to that too. But what he says is that I'm comparing you to the Macedonians so that you can see that your love is genuine. Not that the Macedonians' love is genuine. It is. He says that elsewhere. But that's not why he's telling this to the Corinthians. He's not comparing the Corinthians to the Macedonians so that they will say, wow, what a great church that is. Look at all those godly brothers who are making sacrifices for the sake of others. That's not why he's saying it. He's saying it to them so that the Corinthians can look at themselves and see that in their hearts also is a genuine love. Now, that's a very strange reason to make a comparison, if you will. But I want to tell you that I think this is part of what these passages are teaching us. Part of what these passages are teaching us is that when we look at others who do something well, it can be almost anything, a godly good thing. And it may not be the giving of money. It could be the giving of service or dedication to prayer or some particular talent that's being used in a very effective way. And if we compare ourselves to them or we compare someone else to them, the goal in that comparison is not to think how much better the other person is, but that if God is calling us to do something similar, to realize that the Spirit of God, through the comparison, is stirring love in our hearts to act in the same way, and to recognize that there is within us a love, and there is available to us from God a grace to do our part. In other words, comparison is meant, rather than to make you look small, to realize that you have a greatness in the kingdom. You have an ability to serve in the kingdom. And the reason I emphasize this, and I think perhaps, you know, this is important to the Corinthians here, is that we tend, I think, one of the things I see as an error, I make it myself, we all make it, we look at others, we see how well they do what they do, and then we say to ourselves, I could not do that. Or I don't have what it takes to do that, either in terms of motivation or in terms of ability. Now, we may have different particular skills, and our motivation to do a particular thing may be different than other people's. But the grace that God puts into our lives to love others, and the grace he puts in our lives to enable us to show that love in tangible ways, that's given across the board to everyone. Your job, my job, is to figure out how that works itself out in my life. Who are the people or peoples that God is putting on my heart to show particular love to? And what are the graces in my life that I can extend to them to bless them? So I think this is an important thing to carry forward, because if we go through the passage and we lay out a series of principles, and then again, we say, those are great principles, they're beyond me, I don't know if there's very much I can do with that, then we've totally wasted the benefit of the passage. Rather, it's to say, as we look at the example of others, the godly intent through that is for love and grace to rise up in my heart. Okay, long song and dance on that. Let's go back through these just a little bit more carefully. And to see, because Paul actually speaks specifically to what it was in the Macedonians that made love rise in their hearts to begin with. And the implication is, it happened there in Macedonia, it can happen here in Corinth. And it's a kind of an unusual series of things that come together. It's in verse 2. And, for in a severe test of affliction, their abundance of joy and their extreme poverty have overflowed in a wealth of generosity. There's four things there. I wanna tease that out a little bit. Let me name the four things specifically. There's a severe test of affliction. There's an abundance of joy. There's extreme poverty. And then there is generosity. Those are four things. And they're related. And as I meditated on this passage, it opened up a little bit for me. It says, in the severe test of affliction, and I said to myself, well, what is that affliction? But the affliction really is named, isn't it? The affliction that they're going through, a part of the affliction they're going through, is an extreme poverty. And it's out of this affliction of the poverty they find themselves in that two other things happen. Joy rises up and generosity rises up. Let me say something about this poverty and affliction for a minute. Any form of significant want in our lives where we feel we're without something we want or need. I mean, legitimately want or need. That's, you know, my Cadillac is not running that well. I really need a BMW or something like that. That's not a need the way this passage is speaking about me. Maybe you'll get a better car, maybe you won't. But we're talking about could be basic needs in our lives, like money to pay a very fundamental bill, so there's a roof over our heads, or we have clothing, or to buy food. Most of us don't face things of that degree of poverty, but it could also be a desire to develop a skill or opportunity to serve that we can't. We just, it's not what we want to have or need to have to fulfill something in our lives is missing, and we feel impoverished. And the word affliction is a great term for that. Because the word affliction is carries with it the meaning of being pressed or constrained. I like that word, constrained. Because there are many times in our lives where there are good things in our hearts and opportunities that we see, but due to some constraint on our life, we can't act. I'll give you a very quick example happened to me this morning. So Katie, between her time in colleges, both at Patrick Henry and in New York City, and now working with youth in Shanghai, calls me and says, you know, we have such and such a person in the youth group, or on my hall, or counseling, and I think they wanted to think about killing themselves, or, you know, and I get this medical description of some problem, or they're very sick, and this is the problem. And so I'm long distance trying to put together what's going on. And she says, what do you think I could do? So she called this morning on someone who you could pray that they're ministering to someone who's lost her mother and has a lot of thoughts now herself as a young girl about death. And Katie and Kenny are struggling. What do I do? But one of the things that I would say, and when Katie was here in New York, was we would say, well, maybe this person could come visit us, spend a weekend with us. We just see what they're like. Or just get them out of their environment and give them a little bit of relief from some of the pressure they're under. Well, in a current setting, with her being so far away, I'm constrained with respect to that. There's a certain pressure on my circumstances and on hers that does not allow me to serve in that way. I'm impoverished. I suppose I should pray that I have a supersonic jet that could land in my backyard, but I think that's very unlikely to happen. So there are constraints that come upon us that make it difficult for us to do the good things we want to do, and we feel impoverished. Don't see that as not the will of God for you. God is the master engineer of putting us into difficult circumstances. The promise is that if there's nothing in our circumstances to repent of so we can get free of the things that constrain us, because, I mean, sometimes we're just being foolish and we need to change and then we won't be constrained. But often it's beyond our control. The promise in this verse is that in the midst of a situation like that, if we embrace the constraint that God has brought into our lives, two things will happen. Joy will rise, and generosity will rise. Now, the joy part, I think, makes sense to us. It's intuitive. Because we understand that God is the source of our joy. And if, in the midst of affliction, we set our hearts to draw near to God, we draw near to the source of joy, and that will rise in our hearts. We need to learn to live our lives like that. Otherwise, every time things happen in our lives that bring constraint into our lives, our only other possibility is that we grow discouraged. And we get down on ourselves. Or worse yet, get angry at God. But here, In the case of the Macedonians, they sought the Lord in an earnest way. That word, it's another word that runs through this passage, is earnest. They sought the Lord in an earnest way concerning their impoverished situation, the limitations that were upon them, and God brought an increase of joy in their lives. And out of that, and it doesn't tell us how in this passage, they gained some insights as to how they could be generous. Please notice that if we compare the Corinthians, who tend to be better off financially, from what I can tell reading the passage, to the Macedonians, it's the Macedonians that at this point in time are the more generous. The conclusion there is that generosity is not a function of what we have. Generosity is an attitude of our heart. And what we do with that is a function of what we have. We'll get to that later in a moment when we get to principles. But this is a really, really important thing. And it could be that when we get to heaven, if we get a little survey of the acts of God's people, not otherwise known till now, because who knows what goes on in the world among God's people. Many things are done in quiet and secret. It could be that the greatest acts of generosity may really come out of the lives of the people who are poorest. Not because they gave a lot, but like Jesus said, they had the mite, they gave the mite they had. There's no question that the way in which the Macedonians gave may have required sacrifice on their part. I don't know. Again, we're not given those details. They may have actually given up some things that they themselves needed in order to give to somebody else who they perceived as having greater need. However, it's very important to realize that Paul, in making this comparison, does not ask the Corinthians anywhere in these two chapters to make a sacrificial gift. He doesn't say that. He says, give according to what you have. We'll get to that too. I'll repeat some of these things as we get a little further down. What he's saying is, I want you to recognize that there's love in your hearts that's been nurtured over the course of this year. It's been a year since he first raised the issue with the Corinthians. He says that. That there's love in your heart, and you need, what I want you to do is make a connection between the love in your heart and your actions. That's what he's saying. I want you to see it's there, and I want you to bring it into a completion. Yes?
What was that phrase that was King James? What did it say? Don't give according to what you have.
If a man desires to give, it's acceptable to give according to what he has, not according to what he has not. Yeah, that's, that may be RSV, right? It's not ESV. So.
Could you call that a double negative?
It is a double negative, yeah. It is. That verse is later. I'll get to that verse. Yeah. Yeah, let me finish the principle section here, because I'm still in this. So the main principle I want to say here is that God uses the whole issue of our giving to help us also size up our constraints in our own lives and to recognize that God has a way around our constraints so that we can still be generous. Now, there may come a time where you're constrained because you want to give, you don't have something to give, and you say, well, I wish I could do something else. And you ask the Lord, and he gives it to you, and then you have more to give. Well, that's a blessing, too. That really is. But never feel like the constraints on your life prevent you from being generous. God will bring a grace into your life and give you insight as to how you might be able to give so as to have a heart that's generous towards the needs that you see. Okay. Enough said on that. Let me go down to verse. Let me make one comment on verse 7.
Can I make one comment?
Yeah, please do, and then I'll go to verse 7.
I look at the scriptures and I say to myself, I think what he's trying to say is, instead of just loving a little, love a lot. You know, learn to love a lot.
Yeah.
I know I've been in that category myself where you say, well, I have a desire to help, but I don't have a real big desire.
Yeah.
Now I'm aware of you're saying, right. You know, the Lord really wants you to give.
Yeah.
And say, hey, I'm going to give you the funds.
Yeah.
And that, I've experienced that, where I've given abundantly and kind of put on the side what my immediate needs were. Yeah. Just saying, you know, we've always had enough to give up. So even if I gave everything I had, the Lord would make the way. for us to still pay for what we had to pay.
Yeah.
And it's such a free.
Yes. That's spot. That's a great word. Yeah, I absolutely. That's not a word that's used, but that truth is written all over these passages. You know, that we get keep your life free from the love of money. It's one way. Okay, so some of the principles then, starting in verse 8, I think this is several I want to comment on. Let me just read through the passage slower. I say this not as a command, but to prove by the earnestness of others that your love is also genuine. So this is really a transition verse, and I've spoken about that already. That when you see the earnestness of others in giving, you realize that there's something in your own heart that can get nurtured and put into action. So the first comparison that Paul makes is between the Corinthians and the Macedonians. But then he goes on now in his next verse, and he makes a comparison between the Corinthians and Jesus. Verse 9, you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich. So there's another comparison. It's saying you consider the work of Christ, by whom you have salvation. And one of the ways in which he made grace known was to put off some of the things that he had, the wealth that he had, and he became impoverished by taking on the constraint of a human vessel. And out of that came a generous, lavish salvation. So it's an example to motivate them. But then Paul gets more specific. And in this matter, verse 10, I give my judgment. This benefits you. That's really, you know, it's very interesting that, you know, Paul is not thinking, and some modern giving is this way. It's, you know, there's a need for details, but it can be overdone. Well, we need $100,000. We have 40. We have 6 people we want to ask. You're one of the 6. Could you consider giving 10? You know, break it down and, you know, do some analysis on this. But the emphasis here is not on what the need is. He really doesn't say too much about what the need is in Jerusalem in these 2 chapters. The emphasis here is what the decision about giving will do for the Corinthians. And in this matter, I give my judgment. This benefits you. To go ahead and give, it benefits you. You're going to see that there's love in your heart. There's a blessing that's going to come. And that's talked about later in chapter 9. Who a year ago started not only to do this work, but also to desire it. So that's the first principle. Where do I give? I give in areas in which I have some desire. And in particular, I should go back and look over the past month or 2 months or a year and say, what are the things that have come to my attention about which I have some burden? And did the action I take on those things match the desire I had at that time? Or is there still a desire or an unmet action on my part? So, verse 11. So now finish doing it well, so that your readiness and desiring it may be matched by your completing of it, by what you have. That we've raised this already. I think the teaching here is an important one, and that is we see many things that we'd like to do something about, whether it's to give money or to serve in some way. First of all, we will see many things that we would like to see eased, burdens we'd like to see eased, and it really is not for us to do. That's the first question he asks. Is it a desire that I have and that God is sustaining, and is he directing me to give it? But the other thing we need to recognize is that there are things that God shows us about which we are to act, and there's a readiness in our heart to do something, but we are weak on the point of executing. We don't get through. And so there's this exhortation to finish it so that your readiness in desiring it may be matched by your completing completing it out of what you have. Now, one of the problems that can arise in our giving is we see a need and we don't give in accordance to, we don't respond quickly to that, even though it's something God's prompting us to do. And some measure of desire remains to do something, but we haven't acted it. Now we become aware of it again. Maybe we get another email, or we talk to somebody, or the Lord just drops it into our hearts again and say, you know, there was that need and you didn't act on that. And then we think, you know, that's right. So I heard about that 3 months ago, or 4 months ago. I really wanted to do something. And then comes the big but. The but is, but now I really don't, I had something then to give and now I don't. Or I don't have as much to give and I feel bad about that. And what Paul is saying here is don't let that stop you from doing what you can do now. That is to say, give according to what you have. And he goes on, he says that, verse 12, the one that I quoted earlier. Verse 12, for if the readiness is there, it is acceptable according to what a person has, not according to what he does not have. That is to say, don't compare yourself to somebody else when you make a decision to give, in terms of how much you give, and don't compare yourself to what you were at another time. Listen, there are seasons of life. And some seasons of life we have more than other seasons of life. There's very few things that are a more reliable statement than that. I mean, you know, when you're born and you come out of the, you're day old, you don't have much to give, right? Financially anyway, it could bring a lot of joy. And when we're old and we don't know about, you know, maybe where our minds are not as clear and we can't give with the same clarity, we have less to give. And then there are other times where many expenses are upon us and we have less to give and so on. And then there are times when there's more. And, you know, and I, the teaching that Paul gives on this in Philippians is we should learn to not have abound, have much, and how to be abased, have less. And when we learn to do that, then we know what we have and it's acceptable to give out of that. It is better to give a dollar to something or 15 minutes to something in order to fulfill the readiness that was in your heart one time to act in that area, than not to give it because you don't think it's anywhere near enough. Because what you want to do with teaching here is that you learn to balance your readiness to give with an action. That's the just balance that's being spoken of here. Do something, you know? Do something. And God will bless that. That is what he's saying. And what's more, it is acceptable to God. That's the emphasis. Verse 12, for if the readiness is there, it is acceptable according to what you have. So that's another, and that I think is one of the most fundamental principles of giving. Now there's another one in verse 13. It said, don't compare yourself to others and what they give. Don't compare yourself to yourself and another phase of life. A third thing not to do is in verse 13. For I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but that as a matter of fairness, your abundance at the present time should supply their needs. You know, if there is one, really, there are major teachings in the scripture, you know, the love of God, the fatherhood of God, or making sacrifices, the sacrificial death of the Lord. These are major teachings. Another major teaching that we talk less about, but is profoundly important, is the teaching on social justice. And I've read things on this and I've studied it and I feel a little bit like this is just too hard for me. I'm really trying to learn about this. God is really, really concerned for the poor. You can't read the Bible very long and not see how concerned God is for the poor. The problem is that oftentimes Christians, when they've banded together to have concerns for the poor, sometimes have gone astray. They've gotten confused about what the scripture is saying, and the social gospel arises where we do good, but we forget about why we do good. We forget about Jesus. We forget about salvation. So this whole issue, I struggle with a whole lot, but this verse 13 is a verse about social justice. It says, and the rest of this section, it says, that when you give, the idea is not that, you know, you see somebody who's burdened, you give them lots and lots, they're no longer burdened, but now because of the way you did it, you're burdened. It says that it's not the case. The case is that you should give according to what you have to ease their burden, and you yourself may make some sacrifice but are not burdened. That is, together, you're working together to ease a burden. So that's a profound teaching. And then notice this, that there's kind of a whole process that's released as you do that. Verse 14, your abundance at the present time should supply their need. But it doesn't end with that. He says, so that their abundance may supply your need, that there may be fairness. Well, what's their abundance? We're giving to them because they don't have it. But see, that's the mystery of giving. That's the spiritual dimension of giving. When I give to somebody who's in need, in accordance with the will of God, out of a ready spirit, out of what I have, there rises up in them something that was not there before, a new abundance in their life by the grace of God. It may be financial, it may be something else, but something rises up in their hearts, and that ultimately becomes abundant. God multiplies that in their lives, the lives of the people you gave to, and at some point that abundance then flows back to them. And Paul talks about this later in the second chapter. I'll talk about it next week. And what is the blessing of giving? What's the consequence of giving? But he's hinting at it here. He's hinting that if we properly give to somebody, it's more than just the gift itself. There's a grace that's released in their lives because God commits himself to them. That's what we're reading here. And then notice he quotes the Old Testament verse about the manna. I love this. As it is written, whoever gathered, this is his proof text for what he just said. As it is written, whoever gathered much had none left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. Now, you know, I often, when I thought about the manna in the wilderness, and I read through that, I haven't read through that passage recently, but as I've gone through it over the years, I've often wondered how the guy who took just a little bit had enough. Or even had the guy who took a lot had none left over. And the logical thing to say is that they learned to share. And I said, well, but it doesn't say that. But he says it here. He says it here. The abundance one has, I'll get that question. The abundance one has and the lack that somebody else has gets equalized because they share. And then at another time, when the first one who had less now has more, and the first one has less, they share back in the other way. And that's a biblical picture of social justice. Not the whole picture, but it's an important part. Yes, Eric.
I just was thinking from my practical life experience, you know, I've known various different people, and it seems to me like often people who earn a lot, they spend it all and have nothing left, and people who earn less spend it all and have nothing left. And that's not exactly the same example, but it seems like often when you have a lot, you just waste a lot.
Right. You know? Right, I think that's one of the reasons why Paul, and we'll take just a few minutes to talk about the last section after we take some questions, we'll take just a few moments on that, why Paul sends other people to the Corinthians. Because I think they may well have been spending a lot of what they were making. They may, you know, have businesses that were successful, but when it came time to give, it was gone. And he says, well, let me try and help you. I'll send Titus. I'll send a brother who preaches the gospel. I'll send some other brothers. And I'm going to send Titus first because the contingent will arise serially. If you read the passage closely, you can see that. So first, Titus comes and he says, you know what? These brothers are coming from Jerusalem to take the gift. You've got to be ready when they come. Okay, I'm going to help you out here. I don't want them to all come. Because I said to them that you were ready a year ago to give it. There's another comment, though. Okay, so let me go on to that last section. That's essentially what I'm going to say about this. If you read through Titus, verse 16, I'll just read one or two sections from here. This, again, these are the principles of giving. Another principle of giving. This is a key principle of giving. I'm having trouble giving. I heard what you said, and I kind of get it, but I can't get together the steps I need to take in life to get there. You know, I don't know how to put money aside, or when I put it aside, it goes somewhere else, or I don't know how much, or I can't. Talk to somebody who has experience. Get somebody who can mentor you. This is not an easy thing to do. I mean, some are gifted in this area. There's a gift of giving, right? 1 Corinthians 12, there's a gift of giving. The gift of giving is not necessarily that somebody has a lot of money to give, although if you do, and you have the gift of giving, you should exercise, okay? For sure. But the gift of giving is also to help other people know how to give. How do you do it? I mean, what disciplines do I adopt in my life to make it feasible for me to do without going crazy? You know, I'm losing track, getting confused, feeling like I didn't give enough, I gave too much, you know. I gave the wrong time, I gave the wrong person. Relax, there's grace for this. This whole passage is about grace. So he sends Titus, but the people he sends first are people who have an earnest concern for the Corinthians. In other words, if somebody's going to mentor you or help you in giving, just by talking to you or giving some advice or praying with you or whatever it is, that person should have a concern for you, not just for the person or people that you're going to give to. Because when you learn to give well, there's an act of grace that God is manifesting in your life. And that grace should make you more like Jesus. It's an act of grace. And then if you notice that verse 18, with him we are sending a brother who is famous among all the churches for preaching of the gospel. Now why would you do that for somebody? Send a guy like that when the problem is I have to make a collection. You have to set up a schedule maybe and decide when to give and how to collect it. This is an administrative task. Why are you sending the guy who's to preach? Because the act of giving in the will of God is preaching the gospel. You know, if the world looks at me, they're not going to care that I get up here and share the word with you. They don't care. Or that I do any counseling in the church or that, whatever I might do. And they're not going to care what you do. What happens inside the church means very little to the world. But when we do a genuine act of giving that's sincere and humble, in accordance with our readiness, according to the principles that appear, people see that. They may despise it. They may ignore it. But they see it. It's a judgment. It's a judgment. When God's people are generous and do as he calls them to do, they are preaching the gospel. It's not the only thing that we have to say, because we have to explain the gospel as well with words. I'm not saying we should just give. That's the social gospel again. And it greatly troubles me. But it should be both. They send Titus, you know, who has the administrative skills and the concern for the Corinthians, with the brother who preaches. And he helps him collect the money, and the other guy preaches the gospel. Because the act of giving is an act of preaching. Okay, I think I have to stop with that. And next week, with the Lord's help, we'll go on to the second chapter. Are there any other comments on this?
Thinking about when you mentioned this, a lot of times for me, I may not necessarily always be able to give money, but giving my time or kind of testimonial piece for me was I had a few minutes to text somebody if they were on my mind to pray for them, you know, and I thought I should do that, and I was like, oh, it's not enough time, and it's not, you know, so I didn't do it, and then later on I found out that person actually going for some kind of surgical procedure, and it would have been helpful. I mean, they were not believers, and for me to have tested that could have been something that the Lord would have used for me. God's got grace for all that.
Sure.
But just to be, you know, as the Holy Spirit's prompting me to give of their time or give of that moment and go with it, I think that's good, you know, and that was a good lesson for me.
Yeah.
Go with it.
Good. Thank you. Yes, Brian.
I think also when we read about the references to the gospel, it's a little bit different than like the four steps to go to heaven.
That's right.
When someone is coming to preach the gospel, you know, like in Romans 1:16, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it's the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and the Greek. And there's all kinds of stuff when you read behind and in front of the word gospel in the New Testament that's so rich about the work of Christ in all kinds of levels.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And so when someone's coming to preach the gospel, they're probably not coming to say, you know, these are these four steps you have to take so you can go to heaven.
Right.
It's about the levels of Christ's blessing in your life.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. That's good. Okay, then we'll open to testimonies, okay?